Welcome to this Wednesday's Main Street on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us today. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, Prairie Beat returns to the Devil's Lake region and explores unrelenting floods, a crisis that's been decades in the making, plus a piece of paradise, gardening undercover in southwestern North Dakota. And we begin this Wednesday's Main Street serving up our weekly edition of Prairie Plates.
Welcome to another edition of Prairie Plates here on Main Street. I'm Rick Guillen. We always bring you special guests, and this week we have someone to talk about some Indigenous cooking classes that have been going on here in Fargo at the Indigenous Association. And she goes by the Ojibwe educator, April Smith. Welcome to Prairie Plates.
Thank you. I appreciate the invite.
And you're a food educator and herbalist. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your interest in food and cooking.
So I own Bear Clan Designs, and I wrote a curriculum called Cooking by the 13 Moons. And it follows the Indigenous 13 Moon system, and we learn about what happens historically, monthly with the Indigenous. How did they live? How did they cook? What did they forage for their meals? How did they preserve their meals? And then I wrote all of the recipes for the curriculum. So it's also a hands-on cooking experience. And it's such an amazing class. Right now I am partnering with NDSU, American Indian Public Health Resource Center, and we are having those monthly classes at the Indigenous Center, and our menu is going to be a wild rice squash salad, a Three Sisters salad. I included a berry chicken salad because it's a really good dressing, and I just love that. It's nice for a hot day. And then we're going to have a blue corn noosh with blueberry wajapi. And I wrote all of those recipes, and one of my favorites is the Three Sisters salad. It actually helped me reconnect to my culture, and that's the reason why I wrote the curriculum, is to help people reconnect to culture through food, because food brings everyone together, and food is medicine, and I love that every ingredient has a story, and when we eat traditional foods, we connect to our ancestors. And I feel that just supports us in overall health.
And just so our listeners know, today's cooking class starts at 4 p.m. just after this show. Everyone is welcome. It's at the Indigenous Association in downtown Fargo again, which is 720 First Avenue North. And you have to go up the stairs. No registration is required. Again, free of charge. Just show up. And again, it's in partnership with NDSU's American Indian Public Health Resource Center. I think that's really great that an institution like NDSU can be a part of this. And the Three Sisters are beans, corn, and squash. And what's interesting about it is they kind of grow together in harmony, and then together on the plate, they harmonize as well. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I love the Three Sisters. It's so much more than a really good dish. It represents relationships, understanding. It develops empathy and forgiveness. And it has a story behind it, which is really great. I'm Ojibwe, and that's a part of our culture. Is we do a lot of storytelling and teachings. And corn is the oldest sister, and she is the strongest of the three, and she supports beans and squash. And beans is the second sister. She will climb up corn as she grows, and beans will pull the nitrogen out of the air and bring it into the soil so the soil is healthier for her other sisters. And the youngest sister is squash. She shades the soil. She keeps the weeds from growing. And they all have their responsibility in their companion planting. And it's so great. It's about support and empathy and a really good dish as well. It's such a delicious dish, but it was one of the dishes and plants that really helped me reconnect to culture. And I use that a lot in my classes. And you can actually use different squash. There's winter squash and summer squash. And there's different types of beans and traditional beans you can find. There's a tapari bean that the indigenous use historically. And you can find those online. And it's really awesome to find the traditional ingredients and make these for the class and explain how important they are to the culture. And personally for me, it really helped me with my identity of who I am and helped me want to share this information out more to my community and everywhere else.
We're having a thoughtful discussion today with April Smith, known as the Ojibwe Educator, about her series of fun cooking classes at the Indigenous Association in downtown Fargo. April, thank you for being with us. And I want to ask you about the food trend with Indigenous foods. And I think you've highlighted some reasons, some really good reasons why it's trending right now, the health factor, the harmony, that sort of thing. But I want to ask your opinion on why you think there's a trend with Indigenous foodways right now. I think it's just really a neat and fun thing.
I actually have to say that Sean Sherman helped open those doors for many, many chefs in the United States. Before him, there was not a lot of focus on Indigenous food, and he was able to bring that focus back on how important it is culturally and nutritionally for communities. And through that, there are so many community chefs that have released Indigenous cookbooks, and in their communities, it's so important to become healthy. I love this trend. I kind of don't want to call it a trend. I believe it's a switch in lifestyle. It's who we are and who people can become. I feel that if you are looking at your ingredients and you are growing local and thoughtfully, that those are your emotions that go into food. I wholeheartedly believe that our emotions and our feelings can go into food, which is why I never cook angry, because I feel that you can really get somebody sick with those emotions. And when you put your love into dishes and into food and into teaching, people feel that and they connect with that more. And teaching about bison and how you can include that into your everyday life is exciting. It's new. And I love that people are open to learning. My eyes have just been so happy to see how many community members want to see this information and come to the class. And the class is exciting. The cooking piece is chaotic and it's fun and it's delicious. And I hope you join us down the road.
How can listeners find you? Social media page, website?
So I'm very active on Facebook and you can look for me. I'm the Ojibwe Educator. My website is BearClanDesignsLLC.com. I update that frequently with the next coming classes and upcoming events. And then I am on Instagram, it's bear_clan_designs, and that's me.
And your class here in Fargo is today starting at 4 p.m. right after the show at the Indigenous Association in downtown Fargo, 720 First Avenue North, and you have to go up the stairs. No registrations required. It's free of charge. I think that's just really, really neat. April Smith, thank you for joining us today. It's been a pleasure having a conversation with you about cooking classes, ingredients, indigenous foodways. Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you.
This has been another edition of Prairie Plates here on Main Street. I'm Rick Eon. We'll talk to you next week.
FM Kicks Band presents Jazz Night Saturday, August 1st from 5 to 9 p.m. at 4 and 4 above Side Street. The Jazz Festival follows Sunday, August 2nd from noon to 5 p.m. at Gooseberry Park. Community members of all ages are welcome. Information at fmkicksband.com.
This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. For more than three decades, rising water in the Devil's Lake Basin has swallowed roads, farmlands, and homes. Prairie Beat returns to the region to examine the flooding's lasting toll and why solutions remain so difficult.
Well, hey there, I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. Welcome back to Prairie Beat,
our weekly news podcast here at Prairie Public. It's been a couple of weeks since I've been on the beat, Danielle, and you were out of the office last week doing some traveling for, as I understand, the subject of today's episode.
Yeah, let's just get into it here. We've had some reporting this summer about the rains and the flooding up in the Devil's Lake Basin that continue to be an issue for that community after 33-plus years. I made some calls, I drove up there, and I talked to some folks about that.
Alrighty, well, without further ado, here is that report.
It's been a gradual progression of us losing roads, but what has happened this year is we lost our final, last and only road in and out of here.
15 years ago, Prairie Public produced a documentary series called Mother Nature in Charge. It was about the decades-long plight of the Devil's Lake Basin, which reached its most dramatic heights in 2011. What's happened in the years since is what's always happened. A couple of years of normal to lower precipitation levels drive the lake level down, and then another year or two of heavier rains and snowfall erase all that progress. Lather, rinse, repeat. As many of our listeners may know, I grew up in the Devil's Lake region. I spent my childhood watching my grandparents get chased off their farm, and my dad writing letters with aerial pictures to lawmakers asking for help. And we all felt helpless to watch as the lake ate up the basin road by road, acre by acre, farm by farm. The producers of our documentaries wanted me to sit and talk with my dad about that.
We have about probably over 5,000 acres that are flooded. Most of the land I own is flooded.
What do you remember of having to burn the house?
It was emotional. My dad was not an emotional person. He kept it inside. I can still see him standing there, you know.
He has since handed off the farm to the next generation. My brothers-in-law, Evan Shanefish and Callan Freeman, now own and operate Webster Farms. After some heavy rains inundated the upper basin and began pushing the lake level to more painful brinks once again this summer, I made some calls and did some reporting. But then I drove up to see some of it for myself.
Hopefully you can keep do what you can to keep water off the fields, you know. But there's only so much you can do. It's kind of ultimately in God's hands, and you just go with it.
I used to drive these roads out to my grandparents' farm. Evan now takes them to maintain a 50-year-old tractor they're using to pump water off a section of land they've been trying to keep dry as the upper basin drains. What he's pumping onto went under 15 years ago.
We put a stake in over here. When the big rains came, so we would know how much the lake's gone up or come down. We gotta get it sucked down if we can.
Oh, over here.
Yeah.
No matter who you talk to about the Devil's Lake flood, everyone seems to agree the solution should be simple. But the reality? It's just not. When you zoom out, you realize it's a large basin and a large problem. Jeff Frith is manager of the Devil's Lake Basin Joint Water Resource Board. He also serves on the Ramsey County Commission.
All the water from basically the Canadian border up by St. John area over in the Turtle Mountains flows downhill towards Devil's Lake. And, you know, gravity brings the water down here. and then it has nowhere to go. So it pools and ponds and until it reaches a maximum elevation of 1,458 feet above sea level, and then it flows down the Tullamackoolie into the Cheyenne River.
The Cheyenne River empties into the Red River, which flows north into Canada, emptying into Lake Winnipeg and eventually the Hudson Bay. And Frith says that just about every point along that route, you can encounter a question that needs to be answered before draining meaningful water off the top of Devil's Lake. There are state laws, questions of water quality and aquatic species, and even an international treaty with Canada that promises we won't unfairly inundate them with flood water. Problems with the water in the Devil's Lake Basin can be traced back several generations, with each one facing that question of what to do. Frith has had this job for about 18 years.
You know, the Devil's Lake Joint Board, before I came on board here, had a plan in place to clean out the Tullamackoolie. And they were questioned about the legality of it, and they didn't want to be sued. They didn't want to find themselves in a legal battle. And so when I asked a former state representative about why something hadn't been done, he simply said the lack of political fortitude. And so it's, you know, and that's a tough thing for politicians to hear, but it came right from a politician's mouth, was, you know, we just lacked the resolve to see it through to the end, whether it be local, state, or federal officials. We should have maybe fought harder years ago.
One thing's for sure. At this point, there's no going back. And this has meant everyone in the basin has had to make do with what they have. And what they have a lot of right now, of course, is water. For all the problems the water has caused the agricultural community, it has spurned a strong recreational economy. Susie Kenner is executive director for the Devil's Lake Department of Commerce and Tourism.
Our economic spend, direct spending for tourism in Ramsey County is $61 to $64 million a year. So when you look at it for us as a community, that direct spending for us in the community means a lot. It's probably our second largest industry behind agriculture.
Kenner says many farmers who lost agricultural land to the lake were able to pivot and develop campgrounds and resorts. And she says they are enjoyed by local residents as much as anyone else who travels from far away.
There's not a lot of places in the United States or even in the state of North Dakota where you can get off work at 5 o'clock, the family meet up at home, and you're having sandwiches and water skiing on the lake on a weeknight at 5:30. Or you can go out and fish or do whatever you want with those opportunities out on the lake.
Kyle Blanchfield's grandparents bought their property in the 1940s, making their living farming and ranching. In 1988, he acquired it and took a chance on an idea for a resort. His grandmother's walkout basement became the Cove Restaurant, the pasture became a small campground, and four cabins were available to rent. In 1993, it started raining, and as Kyle puts it, they got chased up the hill a couple of times over the years. The restaurant is currently in its third location, and people travel from all over the country to stay at the Woodland Resort while they hunt and fish.
You know, we've moved 22 buildings. I was involved in 22 building moves. Some of the buildings were moved more than once, so I didn't move 22 buildings, but I was involved in 22. And they, not one of them's fun. Some of them are easier than others. Some of them are really, really tough. Including my own parents' house, which was, that was probably more emotionally difficult than cabins and restaurant buildings, stuff like that. But, you know, you just, what do you do? Either you throw in the cards and say, I've quit, or you get, you know, tough up and deal with it. And we just had to deal with it, so.
Blanchfield says his Norwegian stubbornness, along with belief and support from their local bank, is what kept his business afloat this whole time. And even though today the resort is built to withstand the lake at its highest possible level, he knows the community could not withstand it. A dam at the Tullamackoolie, completed in 2012, prevents the floodwater from spilling over into the Cheyenne River, which would spell catastrophe for everyone along that route. Two small outlets on the east and west ends of Devil's Lake can pump off water at a combined rate of 600 cubic feet per second, and evaporation is supposed to remove about 30 or so inches of water per year. But just ask any farmer, resort owner, or homeowner near the water. These solutions to mitigate the lake level do not keep up with water flowing into it.
Blanchfield grew up north of Penn, North Dakota, a region where thousands of acres are currently inundated. And he says he knows how quickly progress can be erased.
But, you know, we just had these big rains up in Edmore and up north of Kandu, 5-6 inch rains. I mean, the Mavi Coulee was traveling at 1,200 cubic feet per second. I mean, that's like that is a massive flow. It's one of the biggest flows I've ever seen, even since like the 97 floods of when flooded out Grand Forks. That's a ridiculous flow. So that can just tell you, with a flip of a switch, you can either go into a drought or you can flip the switch, turn the faucet on, and we are struggling with too much water.
I can't imagine what this area looks like at 1458. There'd be so much gone. It's hard to even imagine that. I do think that...
Representative Kathy Frelick has represented District 15 in the state legislature, which includes the Devil's Lake Basin, since her election in 2022. We met at a local coffee shop in Devil's Lake where I asked her about her efforts to move the needle on more solutions for the community. Like Jeff Frith, she says political fortitude is hard to come by in Bismarck, but she does have some ideas. Landowners, by and large, have no mechanism to be made whole when their farms are taken by the flood. That's because, due to North Dakota's sovereign lands law, despite the land being in their name and a property tax bill they're expected to pay, that land officially now belongs to the state of North Dakota. It applies to all land under navigable water and below the ordinary high watermark. But Frelick says these laws are written with rivers in mind, not closed basin lakes.
So the bill that I was introducing to our committee basically excludes patent land that was given prior to statehood, excludes that from the Sovereign Land Act, which means that the state can't claim ownership to it. Now that in itself is going to be a huge ask. And there's already questions because of all the lawsuits that have already occurred. But when you look at those lawsuits, they're all surrounding rivers and not lakes. So my thought is that, yes, okay, if we're going to take, if this is going to go to court, if the legislature can pass this, and it means this is going to go to the Supreme Court, let the judges decide. And let's see if they believe that the state owns this land or not. But I don't know if I can get...
Frelick says it's a heavy lift in the legislature because changing those definitions could open a can of legal worms across the state. But it's still worth asking the question. Despite the success of the tourism industry, it does not make up for the lost revenue due to agriculture sector losses. An economic impact study by NDSU in 2011 found annual losses at that time in the $200 million range every year. Frelick and others I spoke with all wished there was more engagement from North Dakota's executive branch of government. I did reach out to Governor Kelly Armstrong's office for comment, but did not receive a response before publishing this report. When I sat down with my dad 15 years ago for Prairie Public's documentaries about the flood, he expressed frustration, but also determination.
Just by nature, if you're a farmer, you're kind of an optimist, and you always try to look at the bright side of stuff. I never thought it would get this bad. I always thought that the powers that be would do something to not let it get this bad. And I'm losing faith.
For now, the only thing they can do is what they've been doing. Evan says he plans to do exactly that.
Do you have any hope of ever farming this part ever again, like right here?
Yeah, I think the lake would have to go down about 3 to 4 feet before we could get this back.
And then what do you have to do to it before you can farm it?
We'd have to pump it all off. We'd have to fix that road, make it good enough to hold water, and then we'd have to pump, and it'd take a lot of money, but we'd have to pump all of this water off, which we've done it before, so I mean we could do it, but it could happen again. But the lake would have to go down probably 4 feet, so you have like a foot freeboard before you could pump over and save it. But yeah, it could be done.
Well, Danielle, what a multi-layered issue. I know that's one that's close to your heart. You could hear the emotion, especially in your dad's voice, but everybody's voice is, everybody has a stake up there. The state has a stake. We all have a stake in this issue, and you really boiled it down to, you know, plain language and made us, help us understand it better. So thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, it is a complicated, hard question for pretty much everybody involved, and it's going to require more people asking hard questions and doing hard work to try to figure it out. I think they can.
Well, so we're lucky we could tap into your expertise, your homespun expertise up there at Devil's Lake. So I'm sure you will be literally on the beat on this subject in the future.
Absolutely.
All right, that's it for this week's edition of Prairie Beat. We'll see you next week. I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
You can subscribe to Prairie Beat, which drops every Wednesday, wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Still ahead on this Wednesday's Main Street, extending the growing season in southwestern North Dakota. That's after this news. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In the July 23rd edition of the Hettinger County Herald, freelance writer Luann Dart shared a story about a farm near Regent, North Dakota, where Shanae Witte has created what she calls her own little piece of paradise. I want to go there. Inside a 100 by 30-foot high tunnel, sweet corn grows as tall as 8 feet, vines climb upright on upright panels, flowers brighten the rows, and grapes ripen for homemade juice. The structure protects Shanae's plants from wind, hail, rabbits, and deer, while allowing her to begin harvesting earlier in the spring and continue later into the fall. But this garden undercover still requires careful planning, plenty of water, and daily attention. Shanae is with us today on Main Street. Welcome to Main Street, Shanae.
Thank you.
Who doesn't want to go into a slice of paradise? What do you see? What meets you first when you walk into the high tunnel early on a summer morning?
So my corn is very far up front this year. And so the first thing I really see is the tall corn. I like to put the flowers up front, but my husband, who is a farmer, insists that I rotate my crops. And so this year, the flowers have to be in the back.
When did the structure first come to be on the farm?
We built it in 2012. It was an NRCS cost share project. And so we were the first ones to kind of jump into that cost share project and erect one in our area.
So what made you want to try it? What did you imagine it would become? And is it today what you thought it would be when you decided to, hey, let's give this a shot?
Well, it really wasn't my idea. My husband is on the NRCS board. And so they kind of coaxed him into trying this program out. And he really thought that after about a year, he'd have storage for machinery and headers in there, because he thought I would grow tired of it. And that has not come true yet.
So tell me what it looks like from afar. What do I see when I'm driving up to your place?
Actually, it's tucked in our yard, and there's trees all the way around it. So when you drive in, you really don't see it. You can't see it until you like get up close to the house, because it's got trees on all sides of it, which is really good because it keeps the wind from ripping the plastic, which is a real issue with these plastic covered hoop houses.
Is this a high-tech plastic or is it just plastic?
Yeah, it's a high-tech plastic that's designed for hoop houses. You order it from the company that we got the hoop house from when you have to replace it. We have only had to replace it three times, so we do better than most people as far as keeping the cover on.
So for someone who's thinking in their mind right now about a traditional greenhouse, is that what a high tunnel is, except maybe taller and bigger and wider?
Right. So like when you go to the little plant nurseries that might be in front of Runnings or one of those, it's like that, only on a little bit bigger scale.
What makes growing or gardening inside one of these different than working outside?
So the plants are protected from the wind for the most part. And so your plants don't fall over from the wind. They also aren't, I want to say stunted, but the wind, you know, lots of wind keeps plants from growing very tall, right? Because they have to fight against that wind. And so my plants will grow taller and bigger just because they don't have to compete with that wind. I'm also able to put in as many inputs as I possibly can. So I can water on a regular schedule. I can fertilize on a regular schedule. I don't have deer and rabbits and things like that to contest with. So, you know, it just, you've got all these optimal conditions that you can create in there.
And I must assume then that the fact that it's covered still allows the sun to do what it needs to do.
Yep. It's a clear plastic. And yeah, that's one of the things I forget. Like in the spring, when I go out there and I start, you know, prepping it, you feel like you're indoors. And so you forget that you're getting sunburned. And so I'll come in like the first couple of days from working out there with a sunburn because I like thought I was indoors and I wasn't, right?
I saw what the temperature was earlier this week in Hettinger.
Right.
How hot is it inside the high tunnel?
So the high tunnel has roll up sides. So the sides roll up about halfway. They roll up about 5 feet. And so whenever, as soon as it starts getting warm all the time, my sides are all the way up. And so air can pass through. And so it'll only be maybe like 15 to 20 degrees warmer than it is outside. In the spring, like before I actually get plants out there and the sides are down all the time because they're down for this, for the winter, it'll easily be 30, 40 degrees warmer than it is outside because the sun goes in there, it's trapped. So like if I could get to the door in the middle of the winter from snowdrifts, it will be warm in there. It'll be really quite pleasant in there.
What about nighttime?
So in the early spring and the late fall, I do a lot of rolling the sides up in the morning and rolling them down at night to trap heat. And so, you know, I can keep it warm in there at night in the spring and the fall just by, you know, regulating that by rolling the sides up and down.
So how many more weeks of growing season do you get versus what I get?
It really depends upon the winter. If I keep the sides down or if I regulate that heat with the sides, it can get as cold as, you know, into the mid 20s before I have to worry about freezing plants. And so I can go into October, November, if we have the right winter, if snow doesn't block the doorway.
If you can just get in, enjoy my conversation with Shanae Witte. She's created a place that she calls her own little bit of paradise. It's a 100 by 30 foot high tunnel where she grows pretty much anything you or I could grow in our gardens, but she does it kind of on steroids. It sounds to me like when you had your first growing season inside the tunnel, Shanae, what did it teach you about what you could and maybe couldn't do that you didn't know beforehand?
So I learned something every year. You know, I've had it for 13, 14 years, and I learn new things every year. And it's been, you know, we've progressively changed and improved it by, you know, laying down fabric, you know, the black fabric they put around trees. So like that covers my whole garden except for the rows that I have exposed to suppress weeds, which I really couldn't do it without having that. I mean, that's too much to weed otherwise. So that's one of those learning points that I just had to get to. I've changed the way I watered to make it easier and more efficient. And, you know, those are just, as you go along, you find things to improve.
How do you water?
So I used to water with a regular overhead water sprinkler that oscillated back and forth. And I, because it's 100 feet long, I'd have to move that thing like 5 or 6 times. It would take all day. So now, just recently, in the last 2 years, I put in an overhead watering. So it's like these sprinklers that are suspended from the middle tier. It's a 13-foot ceiling. So they suspend down 5 feet and they hang at about the 8-foot level. And then they water the whole hoop house at once, which I'm loving.
So you can probably almost put that on a schedule then much easier.
Yes. Yes. I bought a timer. I haven't used it yet because I'm still kind of working the kinks out because we just put it in last year, but yeah, I could put it on a timer and you know, let it do its thing.
What have you tried to grow that just didn't work?
So because the hoop house gets very warm, things that like it cool don't do well. So peas don't do well. Although I had a good batch this year, I don't ever really count on them doing well. So those cool season crops, they struggle a little bit.
And then flip that. What just goes to town? You do it better than I could ever do it in my garden.
Yep. Things that like heat and humidity do really well in their corn does really well because you can put as much water to it as you want. This I put in some ornamental sunflowers. They loved it in there. Things like that, that just take as much water as you can possibly give them. They love it in there. Although you have to be really careful for fungus, right? So like last year was a very humid year here, which we don't have a lot of humidity, but it was very unusually humid here. I had a lot of leaf disease because the humidity, I can't get rid of the humidity that's naturally in the air and it just gets trapped in there. And so, you know, without applying fungicide, I just had a lot of leaf disease.
What do you do with your produce?
You know, a lot of people ask me if I do the, you know, the where you take it into town and you do the
farmer's market circuit.
No, I do not do that. I don't have the patience for that. I like to give my produce away to friends and neighbors. And I have learned to scale back to just what we need and what I can reasonably get rid of without having to, you know, really go out of my way. I put in a lot of more flowers now than I did before, like, you know, like blooming flowers. And then I cut them every week and take them to our church. We have a little country church just a mile from our house. And so I make bouquets for our altar for every Sunday.
What flowers work really well in the hoop house?
In the hoop house, I have zinnias and I have gladiolas. The gladiolas are actually from bulbs that my husband's grandmother would grow. And so those are in there. Those are the two flowers I have in there right now. I've put in cosmos. And, you know, I try something different every year.
So would you say you're an experimenter or a planner when it comes to your vegetables and flowers?
Well, I'm both an experimenter and a planner. I actually participate in NDSU extension study. Thomas Kalb from NDSU does this home gardening research group. And so he will research different fruits and vegetables and flowers. And then you purchase two different varieties and you do trials for him and then you report back the results. And so for the last 8 years, I've done trials for Thomas Kalb on all kinds of things, corn and tomatoes and beans and peas and whatever. My zinnias are a trial. So you get to do up to 8 trials a year. And I usually do 8 of them.
So after this growing season is done, you're going to get to grow a lot longer than me. There'll come a time when you're done for this year.
So one of the things you have to realize is that plants know what angle the sun is at, right? So unless you can put grow lights in there, which I'm not going to do, the plants know when it's October because of the slant of the sun. The plants know when it's March. And so you can stretch that growing season, but they slow down and they know it's time to quit.
When do you begin planning next year's garden?
So I think about my garden all year round. Yeah. So in December, I'm thinking about my garden. And in January, I'm thinking about my garden. I'll usually start seedlings like tomatoes and things like that February or March. If it's a really warm spring, I start sooner because I just get that itch. But I start those in the house and nurse them along until it's time to go out in the hoop house.
Enjoying my conversation with Shanae Whitty. She lives near Regent, North Dakota on her farm where she has a really large hoop house or high tunnel that she gardens in earlier in the season and later than in the season than most of us can. Now, the question I wonder about, Sinead, you don't have a lot of raised beds in the garden.
Nope. The original grant, you know, the cost share from the NRCS restricted you from doing any raised beds. You had to plant into the ground. And so that's how we started. I could put raised beds in there now because the contract with them is up, but I kind of like this. I mean, I kind of like what I'm doing. And, you know, like I say, things evolve and it changes every year. We'll see what happens.
You have, I think, a history of trying new things. Would it surprise people for them to learn about you as someone who works in tech and who works online with North Dakota Center for Distance Education?
No, the people who know me know that I just have lots of different interests. So no, you know, this is my summer thing and all that tech stuff is my winter thing.
So how did remote teaching become part of your career?
Well, that's actually kind of a funny story. So I taught for 34 years face-to-face in New England. And sometime during that career, I was standing at my kitchen peeling cucumbers onto a newspaper for my husband's lunch. And I saw this little ad that said, computer science teacher wanted. I'm like, cool, it's work from home, computer science teacher. I'm like, I could get around that. So I called them and they were like, yeah, we need a computer science teacher. And so they came out and interviewed me, and I was an adjunct with them for 19 years. So I started in 2007. Yeah. And I was an adjunct, which is part-time, right? So I taught full-time, and then I did NDCDE at home in my spare time for 19 years. And then in 2023, I went full-time with them.
What changes in your role as a teacher when the student shucks maybe 100 miles away, a couple hundred miles away from you, and maybe even working in a different time zone?
I have lots of different time zones. In fact, I've had students from South Africa and the Middle East and Germany. And so that is a challenge. You really have to work on that time zone thing. And I have thank goodness Microsoft has all these wonderful tools. One of the tools is a booking link. So they've got a booking page. And so it automatically does the time zone change for the kids. And so I can just send them my booking link and say, here, pick a time that works for you.
I can just see, and I'm sure you don't do this, but a nice table in the middle of your garden with the vegetables on one side and the beautiful flowers on the other side, and you teaching somebody maybe on another continent. Does it ever work that way?
It could work that way. So in the spring, in like the early spring, when I'm really tired of winter and I really kind of want to enjoy some warm, I'll go sit out in the hoop house, even though it's empty and dry and there's nothing in there. I'll just go sit in there just to soak up a little sun. But being a tech person, I'm very much attached to my three screens on my desk. And so taking just a laptop out there to work would kind of be a handicap for me, I think.
As we kind of wrap up our conversation, I think there could be somebody who's listening to this and thinking, you know what? This could be me. This could be a hoop house, a high tunnel could be me. What should they ask themselves before they decide to build a high tunnel of their own?
So one of the things you have to remember is that every drop of water that goes in there, you have to put in there, right? And so you like, we pay for Southwest Water, but if you have a well, you know, you're going to be dumping lots of water in there. You don't get God's watering ever in your hoop house. So that is one limitation that you really have to be realistic about when you go with a high tunnel.
Do you try to capture rain in any way?
You know, my husband and you know, the people on our farm, we've talked about it, and there are ways to do it. My husband's uncle had a hoop house that he did capture rain. It's not as easy as you might think.
Tell us what you're going to change for next year that you've already thought about from this year.
Oh, well, I really don't have a whole bunch of plans yet for next year besides like maybe some new flowers and things in there. I've got some honeyberry bushes in the back that I'm thinking about tearing out, because honeyberries are one of those things that you have to have two plants that fertilize each other. And apparently the two that I ordered were not the right ones because I've never gotten a berry off of them. So I'm kind of tired of looking at them and them not producing anything. So they might have to go. So I might have to dig those out and put something else in.
Do you have bees or pollinators inside the hoop house?
Yes. In fact, last year it was like crawling with bees in there. This year I have a lot less, and I'm not sure why. I don't know if it's the weather, or I don't exactly know why. I'm much shorter on bees this year than last year, but last year there was just a ton of them. I get lots of bees and butterflies and, you know, all those things in there.
Shanae Whitty maintains a 100-foot by 30-foot high tunnel garden on her family's farm near Regent, where she grows vegetables, flowers, grapes, and other crops protected from North Dakota's wind, hail, and even wildfires, I guess. How do the grapes work?
Oh, so the grapes are awesome. They're in the back. I have, you know, the back area is for my plants that never get taken out, you know, those perennials, and so that we only till up to that section and not those. But they're, I have one that's been there the longest, and he puts on lots of grapes. I'm going to have tons of grapes this year. And then in the rows before that one, I've got some new grapes that I put in last year. So grapes have to grapes don't bear right away. So it takes them like 3 or 4 years before they actually bear fruit. And so I'm just sitting on those and keeping them alive until they get big enough to bear fruit.
Stay, thanks for sharing your garden with us. Also, information about your teaching experience and your little slice of paradise. Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Yes, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I want to give, again, my thanks to Luann Dart with the Hettinger County Herald for having this story that I got to see and then bring it to our listeners. So thanks to her as well. If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Travel with Rick Steves. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 29th. Martha and Harry Thompson of Seltz, North Dakota, had 6 children. Son Gust was born in 1923. Tomorrow would be his birthday. He joined the Army when he was barely 18 and parachuted into Normandy on D-Day. Sometime later, he would become a German prisoner. 2 of Gust's brothers also enlisted. Their niece, Jackie Knott, related a story about an episode where Harry, her grandfather, was in the local bar when someone mentioned in German that when Germany won the war, everyone would be speaking German. With 3 of his sons fighting overseas, Harry took exception. Built like a bulldog and really powerful, Harry grabbed the guy and punched him. 4 others jumped in, and Harry took them all on and cleaned the bar out. When Harry's son Gust was liberated as a prisoner, he weighed only 86 pounds. He got a farm in Washington State. He and his wife raised 2 daughters, but they would lose everything in a fire, and Gust's wife ended up leaving him. Gust's sister, Anne, died in 1963. Before she passed, she asked him to raise her 13-year-old daughter, Jackie, a girl he barely knew. Jackie says, "I was bitter and angry when I arrived on his doorstep. He sat me down and listened, and then he told me, 'It may be your parents' fault you are the way you are, but it's your own fault if you stay this way.' The message was crystal clear. Jackie says she owes almost everything to Gust, and she was glad when she had the opportunity to repay him in some measure. As Gust's health failed, he wanted to provide veterans' benefits for his wife, but he couldn't prove he was a veteran. Copies of his military records were lost in the house fire, and a fire in St. Louis had destroyed the originals. Jackie learned Texas billionaire Ross Perot was helping veterans, so she sent him an email. The next day, Perot called her. He would be meeting with the head of the VA and asked her for some hard documentation saying, "I'll shove it in their face and demand they help this man." They found a book that listed POWs, including Gust. Within a week, Gust's wife was approved for survivor benefits. The family was surprised, however, when Gust received a POW disability check. He could have had the benefit all along. Gust passed away 2 months later in June 2004. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Apple TV's adaptation of Cape Fear streams its final episode this week. Actor Javier Bardem has won praise for his cerebral take on Max Cady, the manipulative bad guy with vengeance on his mind.
You are so creepy in this show.
I love Why? Being creepy. Why not being creepy?
My conversation with Javier Bardem on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Wednesday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, a mammoth. hidden beneath a Burke County garage for nearly four decades, is proving to be a rare and unusually complete discovery. In a closer look with the monitor, reporter Michael Ochterlein will explain what scientists are finding and what happens next. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.